Welcome back to another stream. I think I've done like 21 streams this week. We are live right now on X, YouTube, and Rumble. Or if you are watching the replay, don't forget this episode will also be up on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we're doing and want to help us keep going, hit the links in the description or visit ddgeopolitics.com. And big thank you again for getting us to 375,000 on X and 38,000 on YouTube. Quick note about YouTube, we are very shadow banned, no notifications. We are not even on the front page, even if you subscribe. So make sure that you're, I don't know, interacting with the YouTube. I don't know how to fix it. Interact with the YouTube, share the YouTube, get it out there. And I guess I should also explain the thumbnail because people had some questions about who Trump was dreaming about. But Trump did tweet this week, which was has to be one of my favorite tweets of all time from Trump. Or Truth Social, sorry. Has anyone noticed that since I said, I hate Taylor Swift, she's no longer hot? How are you doing, Murad? Welcome back. It's good to see you. How was
the week? Not exactly the fireside chats from our president, but I'm doing well. Thank you. Who produced the intro music, by the way? I keep forgetting to ask.
We'll have to ask the producer, but I'm not sure.
It's kind of a jam. Yeah, it's that
sort of Russian music. I don't know how to explain it.
Music, yeah.
All right, and I, like I said the last time, we would talk about what we were reading this week, and I want to talk about this book. It's called Fascism, The Career of a Concept. It's fire. It's by Paul E. Gottfried. I like to call myself a subject matter expert in Eastern European fascism, but this is really good because it's discussing fascism as a reaction to the left. And then it goes through all the different schools of political science and what their specific criticisms of fascism are. So really good book. Maybe we'll try to contact the author or something. This week we have Russia-Ukraine talks, Trump's Middle East extravaganza, and the commencement of Operation Gideon's Chariots in the Levant. So we'll get started with the Russia-Ukraine talks. We had a Russian delegation, and I want to get your reaction or thoughts on the message that Putin sent by sending, this delegation. It was led by Medinsky as a presidential assistant. The key members were the deputy foreign minister, the head of the GRU, and the deputy defense minister, as well as a miscellaneous negotiation expert staff of civilians. I thought that the actual delegation itself sent a message, and I wanted to know if you thought the same.
Yeah, like everyone's just, while Trump is there, it's kind of like when kids are like, kind of abuse a situation when they're being supervised by someone who doesn't pay that much attention. And I feel like every side, both the West, you know, or like Europe and Russia, are both just kind of playing Trump, where they're doing this little theater. And, you know, on Russia's end, they are, you know, not open to peace, you know, as it's framed. And, you know, from the Europe side, they're just doing everything they can to drag this out, it looks like. So they're perfectly okay presenting ultimatums, which they know that Russia's going to reject. And Russia's perfectly okay sending these unserious delegates, right? And we're just, once again, we're extending the war out further, right? So Each week I sit here with you and I feel like the war is going to be even longer.
I know. I mean, we'll get a little bit to that, but I thought that the message that they sent was very much like we're sending a very military heavy delegation, which sends the message that we are ready for this to continue. We know that it will continue. And they also sent a few negotiators from the Syria negotiations from prior, not this most recent coup, but a lot of hardliners. So I think that there was, and also you mentioned them being kind of a low level, and that was actually Zelensky's chief complaint. His delegation, Zelensky, did go to Istanbul, Constantinople. No, it's Istanbul, or however the song goes. But Zelensky did go and try to posture and say, I'll be there. We'll see if Putin shows up. And he brought his defense minister, the deputy head of the SBU, the first deputy foreign minister, and senior officers from GUR, the general staff, and the foreign ministry. He wound up leaving early and not attending the meeting to go do drugs in Albania. But he did complain on the 15th that he was not happy with the delegation and hemmed and hawed, and the meeting that was supposed to take place on the 15th wound up taking place on the 17th with Russia and Turkey meeting prior. And interestingly enough, Russia outwardly and verbally opposed all U.S. involvement and said that they did not want them at the talks. What do you think about that?
This is just crazy to me. This is like someone standing up someone on a date almost, this kind of diplomacy where, you know, Zelensky's going there expecting, you know, to be met there with by his peer, and he, you know, sees people that, you know, that are a tier below. There's this confused messaging. Well, of course there's confused messaging already from Trump, but this confused messaging from Russia or from each side here that they're just kind of shutting the US out. I really think that this is once again just another step further in this development where the US is increasingly less relevant in these affairs, whether that's multipolarity, you know, or just the US decline. We are seeing more and more situations where the US is not summoned or they're not solicited to come, and they, you know, they don't want them there.
Kind of refreshing in a way. I don't know. I kind of like to see people sort of put in their place. And also, interestingly, the talks took place in Russian, fluent Russian from the Ukrainian delegation. The meeting lasted no longer than 2 hours. That is a short meeting for a very long war.
Zelensky, well, I don't think he's tripping about this, because why? What would he be in a hurry for? So this all is perfectly fine by him. Thanks.
So according to what we've heard is that Russia demanded the full withdrawal of Ukraine from four of the territories. And Ukraine obviously scoffed at the idea. They asked for four territories, to which the Russian delegation said, we said five. And then Margarita clarified and said, the story has been making the rounds that Ukrainians were outraged when Russian negotiators said that Ukrainian soldiers must leave the four new Russian regions as part of the ceasefire, to which the Moscow delegation replied, next time it will be five. Now our reporter in Istanbul got to ask the Russian side how it really went down. We didn't say five. We said eight. Eight. Oh, what eight are we thinking here? The Donbas, Donetsk, Lugansk, Zaporozhye, Kherson, Nikolaev, Sumy, Kharkiv?
Odessa? Did you already say Odessa?
No, I didn't. Maybe Odessa?
Yeah. I understand Russia's strategy here. They're basically saying give up four regions now or it'll be eight, like, or, you know, be forced to give up eight later. The thing from the Europe side is, or at least from Ukraine side, right? I'm almost worried, why wouldn't their strategy just not be trying to, you know, squeeze out this existential crisis as much as they can until Europe is just like, decides if we don't help now, or if we don't continue pushing for this, Russia will be on our doorstep. So to make it Europe's existential crisis. I really fear that Ukraine's kind of in this like do or die mode, or going to be approaching there, or at least their leadership, right? Because like I don't know what they're being told, you know, to keep rejecting these offers like this. Okay, next week it'll be five, or it'll be eight, you know, in the week after that. And then
I think Lavrov was the one who said every time that we have talks, it'll just increase from there. We'll just keep going from there. We do have a video of the reaction from the Moscow delegation, and let me grab that. Oh, here's a great moment from the talks. If you guys need this, I'll post it on Twitter, but it's a great reaction video.
Bir husus bir hadise vurgulamak isterim. Bundan sonraki aşamayı yapacağımız tercihler ve
Smedinsky, the Russian delegation. But here we go. Here's the Russian reaction.
Уважаемые коллеги, прямые переговоры с украинской стороной, организованные по инициативе президента России, только что завершились. В целом мы удовлетворены результатом и готовы продолжать контакты. О чем договорились? Первое. В ближайшие дни произойдет масштабный обмен пленными 1000 на 1000 человек. Второе. Украинская сторона запросила прямые переговоры между руководителями государств. Мы приняли этот запрос к сведению. И третье. Мы договорились о том, что каждая сторона представит свое видение возможного будущего прекращения огня. Пропишет это в деталях. После того, как такое видение будет представлено, мы полагаем целесообразным, тоже об этом договорено, продолжить наши переговоры.
What are you have any thoughts on that reaction? Quite dry.
Yeah, I mean, I do find this interesting. You know, we'll see what they come with, because that's almost a put up or shut up to come bring, you know, the vision for what a ceasefire looks like. Great. Yeah, let's see what each side presents and whether they'll, you know, hold true to that. But the reaction here didn't surprise me. That it was fairly, you know, dry is one way to put it, just fairly formal language. But yeah, that was the most interesting part to me. I'm surprised they haven't come with that yet. Right, like with you requesting that, it's like, so what have you guys? You haven't been bringing that
what
already.
What are you talking about? Yeah. What's been? I am sure that a lot of the EU had a lot to say. There were reactions across the board. They were having some sort of drug fueled meeting in Albania. I don't know what was going on. There was a video. An area asked if I wanted it, and I just said no. It was a video where they. I think that Albania discovered AI, and it made a video compilation of all the world leaders that attended as babies, and each baby said, "Welcome to Albania." So they waited 2 minutes of each EU leader as a baby. Say, it was the most cringe, horrible thing. And I was like, I cannot play 2 minutes of Albanian AI art. But here's the Moscow delegation laughing at Poland. Another tidbit from inside the delegation to our correspondent. Big laugh from Moscow team in Istanbul when a Ukrainian claimed Russia was planning to invade Poland in 2030. Medinsky smirks. Let's not turn these talks into a fantasy novel. I'm glad that they are finally head on addressed the rumors that Russia cannot wait to go into the Baltics and to reinvade Poland and all of those sorts of things.
If you're one of those Eastern European countries right now, I mean, why wouldn't you do this? Like, woe is me, the sky's falling,
if you're in the position to do so and to benefit from it. Russia's reaction to much ado about nothing was to strike the hell out of Kiev and the region, as well as other regions. Huge drone swarms last night hitting the airfield in the Kiev region. Trump's response to it was to say, I will be speaking by telephone to President Vladimir Putin on Boomer text of Russia on Monday at 10 a.m. I don't know 10 a.m. whose time. The subjects of the call will be stopping the bloodbath that is killing on average more than 5,000 Russian and Ukrainian soldiers a week, and trade. You had to make sure you added trade in there. I will then be speaking to President Zelensky of Ukraine, and then with President Zelensky, various members of NATO. Hopefully it will be a productive day. A ceasefire will take place, and this very violent war, a war that should have never happened, will end. God bless us all.
I did that. God bless us all. He usually doesn't say that. Why is bloodbath in quotes? Why does he still tweet in all caps? He put, I'll meet with President Zelensky, and then with President Zelensky, like...
Yeah. It's like he's trying to be formal. President Putin of Russia, President Zelensky of Ukraine. Like, he's like announcing them as they walk into the hall. The coalition of the work, I think that the producer calls them coalition of the butthurt, but they're in all seriousness calling themselves the coalition of the willing, is scrambling today to stop Trump from talking to Putin or to make sure they get their opinions in before the call takes place. And Putin did have a have something to say today about it.
У нас достаточно сил, средств для того, чтобы довести начатое в 2022 году до логического завершения с нужным для России результатом. А этот результат – это устранение причин, которые вызвали этот кризис, создание условий для долгосрочного устойчивого мира и обеспечение безопасности российского государства, обеспечение интересов наших людей на тех территориях, о которых мы всегда говорим. Там, где проживают люди, считающие русский язык родным языком, считающие Россию своей родиной.
So, once again, I mean, I can play tapes from 2022. We're just saying, they're just reiterating what they've said for the last 3 years. Also, interestingly enough, besides the baby video, in Albania and the Albanian president rightfully bowing down to Georgia, Queen Georgia Maloney, by the way, as it should be. We did have a surprise meeting. I didn't expect that music. Thank you, Aria. But unless you can read lips, I guess you don't know what they're saying, although Aliyev looked considerably annoyed and Pashinyan looked very engaged. What are your thoughts, our Armenia-Azerbaijan expert, Murat?
I don't know if Aliyev looked annoyed. I think that, unfortunately, that meeting is sort of welcomed by both of them. But this comes part of the developments where, you know, these two countries are working out these peace talks. Now, the peace talks are, you know, will not be favorable to Armenia. And that's, you know, kind of the scary part of this is, you know, Armenia has little leverage. And so that's what everyone waits with bated breath for. But, you know, like Pashinyan's, I believe, maybe made a social media post about this. Once again, he continues to be sort of like positive or cheery about, you know, rather horrifying, prospects. But one interesting thing that happened this week was I got a DM from an account, like a botted account. And it was, it sent me a link to a story that was reporting that Aliyev was giving an Azerbaijani medal, an order of friendship to Alan Simonyan and another cabinet member. They were asking me to tweet the story. And I did find this strange because I'm not the biggest, you know, Armenian news account. And no one had really posted about this story, except for one account, fairly major account, who then later ended up deleting the story because they probably realized it was a fake news story. But I did find it interesting that this was clearly an Azerbaijan-sourced fake news story, but for whatever reason, Azerbaijan elements within kind of the nationalist Armenian side, somebody out there, you know, wanted this kind of narrative out there that Azerbaijan is giving these orders of friendship to cabinet members of, you know, the Armenian government. This is, of course, to kind of sow chaos or to freak people out, you know, because, you know, this is a very alarming thing to be, you know, an Armenian official who's going to be receiving a medal from Azerbaijan. These kinds of absurd stories pop out like in these moments. My eyebrows just are raised whenever someone tries to get me speaking on it, because then I'm just like, why do you want me on the record? Like,
you're getting famous now, so.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. I always find that interesting. So yeah, that story is fake. I mean, it hasn't been confirmed that these Order of Friendship medals are being given. The story was being reported; they were being given in a closed ceremony too. So it's an outlandish story. As for Pashinyan and Aliyev, the thing to watch out for here is how involved Russia is in that meeting. Because if they're bilaterally working something out and they're pushing, you know, Russia is no longer involved as the mediator here. That's big for, that's an opportunity for Turkey. That's an opportunity for Iran, who, you know, won't lunge at it the same way that Turkey will. And Turkey is expecting to fill the vacuum, you know, if Russia is pushed out. So Yeah, I would watch out for how involved Russia is in those talks and, you know, kind of how they navigate or dictate how that goes.
Interesting. Also happened this weekend, the coronation of the new Pope, where Zelensky had to meet with his handlers. I'm not sure what that's about, but just something to note prior to the Putin Trump conversation, Zelensky did meet with Vance as well as Rubio and a few others as well. Moving on to this is the big chunk of the show, the Middle East extravaganza, I'm calling it, because it was literally like 2 months of heavy pandering and lobbying of the Middle East. And if you want to get into the pregame, I guess you would call it, the Trump son's pre-tour, which there was a report in the New York Times, Trump families is rapidly striking business deals in the Middle East. We talked about it a little bit on the show. There's a thread, it's pinned on the big account if you guys really want to read it. But before Trump went on this trip, his sons, Donald Jr. and Eric, they already went on a tour of the Middle East, namely the Gulf states and Eastern Europe. I went into very deep detail in that thread. If you guys, again, if you want to take a look, but just really quickly, we have the tower in Saudi, the $500 million tower. In Qatar, we have the $5.5 billion golf club. In the UAE, we have the 80-floor skyscraper, as well as the $2 billion injection of capital from MGX to the WLF. Now, for our viewers, the WLF is the World Liberty Finance, which is the Trump's crypto endeavor. So an MGX, it gave it $2 billion of injection, which is a UAE, and MGX is a UAE state-backed fund. So Trump's crypto is funded by UAE state dollars, just so we understand that. So these weren't casual visits, obviously. They were probably laying the groundwork and kind of taking the temperature and testing like investor sentiment ahead of Trump's arrival. You know, we have to avoid embarrassment at all costs. And so that's kind of what this looked like, kind of getting the fanfare sort of worked up. Also, Jared Kushner advised everyone on the trip prior to going. Everybody knows Jared Kushner to be the architect, one of the main architects of the Abraham Accords, that he's still trying to get everybody instituted in. And then we also had the Trump rift with Netanyahu, which we now know to be fake. We'll get to that later. But all of that leading up, as well as the ceasefire with Ansarallah, all of that leading up to Trump's big trip. So lots of things happening before Trump gets to. I thought that was so interesting. Like, I know that obviously in Islamic culture, women are customarily almost always cover their hair. And I thought it was a really interesting sort of ceremony. I guess it's very specific to the Emiratis, the way that they were.
It was an Emirati.
Yeah.
Tradition or dance.
Yeah. Very,
it was very nice. I suppose it was nice.
I mean, if you like hair. I also, notable CEOs on the trip for obvious reasons: Elon Musk, Larry Fink of BlackRock, Stephen Schwartzman of Blackstone, Sam Altman of AI, of OpenAI, Alex Karp of Palantir. Every week we talk about Palantir. Other notable CEOs include IBM, Citicorp.
You know when he landed it?
Boeing, Google, Amazon, NVIDIA, Halliburton, Northrop Grumman, Coca-Cola, and Uber. First stop was Saudi Arabia. You know, and I want to go through these because the big thing that MAGA is kind of saying is like $1 trillion in investments. Well, let's talk about what the actual investments are. Every MAGA that I ask, I said, well, what are they investing in? Most of them don't know. So we're going to talk about it. We have $600 billion investment commitment from Saudi Arabia. $142 billion arms deal, which is supposed to be the largest defense sale agreement in U.S. history, an AI partnership. So tech giants NVIDIA and AMD, they both secured deals to provide chips and infrastructure for Saudi Arabia's new AI firm, which, funnily enough, is called Humane. So very interesting from Saudi. NVIDIA plans to deliver 18,000 of its latest GPUs, and AMD entered a $10 billion collaboration. Obviously, Palantir is involved in expanding its presence. SpaceX scored a satellite internet, SpaceX scored a Starlink contract for all of Saudi Arabia's aviation and maritime sectors. OpenAI is possibly establishing a data center there. And I want to make sure that our viewers understand that all of these are MOUs, which are memorandums of understanding. Now, they are non-binding. They don't have specific terms, and they are very untraceable. Other companies that received huge contracts were Google, Oracle, and Salesforce. And Uber committed $80 billion to do an automated fleet of taxis, which I'm sure are going to be by Tesla. So that's what Saudi Arabia was. Also, there was an Aramco deal in there. So, I mean, so far we're building up the infrastructure of Saudi.
So the first thing I thought of was it's so like Trump, you know, as you mentioned about the MOU, right? It's really nothing, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like a whole lot of hot air. But this is the hot air president where, you know, everything is kind of sold as a win. Everything is sold as a improvement. And, you know, we're going to get tired of winning. And really, it's like it is just a nothing burger. Right. And so, well, not that if this, you know, goes through, this would be a nothing burger. I'm not saying that. But for right now, kind of as you said, this is, you know, being kind of overhyped for the time being. This is more of, you know, Trump's. I don't know what to call it. Nobel Peace Prize tour. I think he wants to be the, I think someone got in his ear that, you know, you could be the president that ends wars. We're not going to start wars. We're going to end. And so like he's going around and just pretending like he's ending these various conflicts, whether the entities involved feel wanted to end or whether they feel like it's ended. He's just going around like, yeah, it's all good. We got it taken care of. Meanwhile, like India and Pakistan are like, yeah, no, the US is not even involved. Like, I don't know what he's saying. Anyway, so like, yeah, so right here, you know, he's in the Gulf. I mean, wow, the Trump and the Gulf. This is a fascinating thing because we're seeing a situation where, you know, someone's personal interests or personal kind of inclinations may overtake national interests. And we may just kind of pivot to the Gulf, because, you know, kind of on Trump's whim. There was that article I saw in the Atlantic about there's like a bag of world rift over the Israel and Gulf, like, you know, factions. And, you know, we'll see what comes of that. But yeah, I mean, this is the Gulf really, they knew how to go out the red carpet for him. And, you know, some things worked, but yeah, we'll see. I mean, we'll make sure that we'll see how these MOUs and stuff develop and see what once it's all, you know, written in stone.
Well, we do have Trump's reaction interview after. We'll go through those clips in a minute, but also in Saudi, what everybody kind of also made a big deal about was the meeting with Syria's new president, al-Julani, al-Sharaa, whatever you like to call him. But leading to up to that meeting, in late April, early May, Julani, that's when he began making overtures to the U.S. intermediaries. And on May 11th, not a lot of people know this, Jonathan Bass, which is a very unknown, I had to like dig pretty deep, flew over to the to Syria, met with him, with Jolani in Damascus. He's described as a pro-Trump activist, whatever that means. He said, he told me he wants a Trump Tower in Damascus. He wants peace with his neighbors. What he told me is good for the region and good for Israel. I don't know who this guy is or why he was pegged to go over there, but he went. He's probably some influencer or YouTuber that we just... Because that's who seems to get all the deals in in a Trump's world, I guess. But on May 13th is when Trump made the big announcement. He's lifting sanctions. And I for one, would love to see sanctions getting lifted off of Syria, even if it was under al-Sharaa, because the people of Syria should have relief. But here's the thing. He can't lift sanctions because of how they're put in place. So is this just more empty promises? He can rescind the sanctions that were put under by executive order. So for those of you guys who don't know, and I got into an argument with someone the other night, they're like, well, they're only sanctioned because of Assad. No, these sanctions have been in place since the 70s. There are sanctions that are under EO, and there are sanctions that are under congressional order. Trump can lift the sanctions that are under EO. Congress has to lift the ones that are under congressional order. So there's no real... like, there's no immediate sign that these can be lifted at all.
He may just come out one week and just say that we're going to annex the moon, you know, and just kind of just go with that and just be like, I don't know, maybe we're doing it, I guess. It's like, yeah, I mean, it's really hard to, like, once again, I feel like everyone's kind of having fun with this, you know, as best as they can, where they're just kind of, there's this ridiculous person in front of you who you can, you know, manipulate or charm, and he'll just, you know, go out there and say whatever. I know there's a lot of people that were let down and hurt by, you know, him even meeting with Jolani. But I mean, I suppose I was a little surprised that people were taken aback by that, because why would he not meet with him? You know, right. Is there anyone that Trump wouldn't meet with? I don't think there is.
I don't think he would refuse. I don't think he would refuse to meet with most. I can't think of any that he would. I mean, he met with Kim. So if you're going to meet with Kim, he's probably willing to meet with anybody. And this is Trump's reaction to meeting Jelani. This is from his interview after. And we'll get more. We have more clips from this interview. But really quickly, this is his reaction to meeting with al-Sharaa.
Now, when you get to Syria. So I did something with Syria because the future king, and you have a wonderful king right now, he's an older man. He's also a friend of mine, and he's 100% sharp. He's great. And he's got a great son, the crown prince. And he has actually many titles. He's prime minister, he's crown prince, and he's doing a great job running it. But he called me and he spoke to me and he said, could you do me a favor? Do the world a favor? Could you take the sanctions off Syria? Because the only way they're going to have a chance, the sanctions are crippling, really biting. Well, that's what I did with Iran, and they came to a point where they were bust. Could you take the sanctions off? I hadn't thought about it much, and he said it in a way that was, you know, he's got a great heart. He said they can't make it with those sanctions. I said, let's give them a chance. I met the leader. I met the new leader, and a handsome guy, by the way, young, handsome. And I said, you know, you have quite a past, got a tough past. But when you think about it, are you going to put a choir boy in that position? I don't think so. You know, it's going to be a little bit tough. It's a tough part.
So you're willing to give him a shot.
You know, the way they say it's a nasty neighborhood. It's a rough neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I thought he was really, yeah, I thought he was terrific. He was so thankful about the sanctions because he knew he's not going to be able to bust through.
Got a tough past. Like, he grew up on the streets of Brooklyn.
It's a rough neighborhood.
It's a rough neighborhood.
You don't want a choir boy in that position. Yeah.
Humanize. Like, he's going out of his way to, like, very much humanize the Saudi regime and al-Sharaa. Like,
he called me and I'm surprised Trump didn't do it. You know, when he refers to, like, someone speaking to him, he's always like, and they said, sir. I'm surprised he didn't do that here with Jelani. But he's like, he called me and he said, will you do the world a favor? that was my favorite part of that. He's like,
will you do the world a solid?
And then he's like, when he asked me to lift the sanctions, I hadn't thought of it much. But it's just right. Like,
that was my favorite part. You didn't think about it? Did you even know they existed? It's soon here.
Yeah. Did you want to, like, take care of those at some point? Or, like, how long did you plan on leaving them for me? Yeah. I mean, it's just maddening.
Here are some conditions for Trump's lifting of the sanctions. Normalize ties with Israel, expel all foreign terrorists. We don't know what the definition of that is. And to help manage ISIS detainees in U.S.-controlled areas of eastern Syria. There's a few issues with that. Israel is bombing Syria with American weapons and invading them in the south. How can they expel foreign terrorists when most of their government is made up of Turkic people from the Central Asia region? And C, how will Jolani feasibly help manage ISIS detainees when A, he's an ex-ISIS member, and B, he really doesn't have much much control over the actual workings of Syria itself. He can't get his guys to stop attacking the Druze in the south. How will they organize something to help? And this isn't really about ISIS. Let's be honest. This is about holding on to the oil fields.
Right. And this is referring to the Abraham Accords. Right? I saw that he was discussing the Abraham Accords with Syria. The Golan is probably one of the big, holdups here that they won't budge on, probably, because I imagine that would be a condition for Syria, is that the Golan's returned.
I don't think that al-Sharaa cares.
You don't think so?
Which is interesting, because Jolani, obviously, al-Jolani means of the Golan. That's what his name literally means. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not really sure. I think that he would give it up. I mean, there's a whole neighborhood or a whole settlement named for Trump. Was it Trump Heights or something like that? Trump something. And there's a settlement in the Golan Heights named after Trump. So they're not. Yeah, you didn't know that? Yeah.
I didn't know that.
No. Yeah. That was kind of one of the things that Trump did with Bibi the last time. All right. So we go over to Qatar. Now, this one is the interesting of the three, because... Well, prior to when him going there, we have this the plane debacle, which I love the plane. Only stupid people would say no to a free gift. So I don't even care about the plane, but the Zionists and kind of the Orientalists are going absolutely berserk over the plane. The Free Press, which full disclosure, it is Barry Weiss's publication, but the Free Press went absolutely ballistic and did a huge article. You guys should go read it, about how Qatar bought America. And they broke down the spending, which I was pretty intrigued by. I didn't realize there was that much of investments from Qatar. I always thought that it was kind of a Chicken Little, the sky is falling sort of thing that we heard from the Zionists. So I decided to dig in a little bit more. So the Free Press article states how Qatar has spent over $100 billion in the last two decades in order to gain influence. That's their phrase. In the U.S., that was just more than any other government. So I went and I dug into the admin. Thank you, Laura Loomer. Laura Loomer tipped me off again. Telling you guys, Laura Loomer. She gives me the thread and then I have to go pull it. But still, she's the one who brought this to my attention. I'm not kidding. Pam Bondi, who she calls Scam Bondi. I don't know if you can read this, but this is showing that she was designated as a key personnel, receiving over $115,000 a month from the Embassy of Qatar to Ballard Partners, which is a powerhouse lobbying firm located in Florida. Heavy GOP ties. Interestingly enough, her work, and this is a quote, her work was framed as anti-human trafficking. Now, everybody's going to say, great, anti-human trafficking. No, she was there to whitewash Qatar's PR problems while they were building up for FIFA. So that kind of human trafficking, which I thought was really interesting. Because Pam Bondi still hasn't released the Epstein files.
And this human trafficking, as I understand it, the kind that's super prevalent there refers to bringing in, like smuggling in labor, right? Like, mm-hmm. Right.
Correct. And others as well. Just to note, Pam Bondi was the attorney general during Epstein's first cases. And all of the complaints against him from 2011 to 2019. After that, Pam Bondi joined Ballard Partners as a partner, which she worked there for 5 years until she was inducted into the Trump administration. She was working for Ballard Partners and registered under the Foreign Agents Registration Act. So she was registered under that act, with just her due diligence, and good on her. She's the one who directly approved the $400 million jet gift from Qatar to Trump. The Ballard Partners is also going to come up again, but they were founded in 1998 by Brian Ballard, who is a huge Trump fundraiser. And they have clients like Amazon, Google, Uber, and foreign governments, i.e. Qatar. Susie Wiles, who is Trump's chief of staff, was a senior partner at Ballard Partners from 2011 to 2019. Wow, right when Pam was the attorney general. She was also the former CEO of Mercury Public Affairs, which represented the embassy of Qatar in 2024 for a $180,000 contract. She oversaw operations during the period that they were contracted with Qatar. And what was their contract for? To improve image to improve their image with image rehabilitation, U.S. outreach, and messaging during key geopolitical moments, including scrutiny over Qatar's labor practices. So another one covering up for human trafficking. Moving on. Kash Patel, the FBI director. He was a consultant for Qatar's embassy from 2022 to 2024 via his firm Trishul LLC, which earned $2.1 million in 2024, roughly. Services are described as national security, defense, and intelligence consulting, but he never registered under FARA. This was disclosed only after it came up in his confirmation hearings, but he was never questioned on it. Moving on. that's not it. The last one, Steve Witkoff, who was obviously on the trip, appointed special envoy to the Middle East with no previous political experience. He's a real estate mogul and a longtime Trump friend. And of course, he's a golf buddy. Importantly, Witkoff received a bailout from Qatar on his failed hotel in Manhattan, $623 million for the Park Lane Hotel, which the Qatar bailed him out. And he sold it to them. Also, please don't forget his wonderful son, Alex Witkoff, who, as you can see, the Qatar Real Estate Forum, a speaker, he helped broker that deal. So all of these people are very, very, very tied to Qatar. Where, you know, and it was interesting to me, because everybody says, you know, it's Israel. Israel's fully infiltrated. And these people really, the group that I was just talking about, they don't really have any tangible ties or loyalty to Israel. It's quite a departure.
Yes, I was going to start this off by saying there is a small country in the Middle East that controls America, and it's not Israel, it's Qatar. But yeah, I mean, that was key what you said, that like this is not an Israel aligned entity, and oftentimes they kind of blaze their own trail. And I mean, how much oil do they have? Like a country of that size, I feel like, shouldn't have that much wealth or the ability to throw cash around like this.
That's like Kuwait.
The plane thing is ridiculous. I mean, that's
it's insane, the amount of wealth. And it's also quite scary, because they have so much wealth that to them it doesn't matter, but to other people it very much matters. So their ability to manipulate things at their will is very scary. Also, guys, don't forget, like I mentioned earlier, the golf club in Qatar, which is $5.5 billion for a Trump. It's Trump branded. And the WLF, obviously, their deal. There's a Qatar investment in that. The full amount is not disclosed. And never forget, Jared Kushner's Affinity Partners, the private equity firm, has a $1.7 billion investment from the Qatar Investment Authority. So they also bailed out. And that was, I don't know if you remember, a lot of people might remember the 666 Fifth Ave that Kushner owned. And it was the biggest sale. The Qataris had to bail him out of that too. So these guys are kind of indebted to Qatar.
There is like, I know in the foreign policy establishment, there's concerns because America is, you know, Trump won't be here forever. But like during this time, if, you know, you damage certain alliances or certain relationships, that, you know, that can be particularly damaging to the U.S. going forward. And so like here we see, you know, a pivot from Israel, which a lot of people, you know, would welcome. But, you know, in other cases this week, we saw him changing his tune on India. And so, because the Apple investment, right? And so now he's walking that back. And so people are like, is he annoyed with India because they spurned him on the ceasefire thing? And so it's like our leader can just go out there and change on a whim based on how he's feeling, you know, about you personally. And so this is very personal and transactional diplomacy we're currently engaged in. And yeah, I mean, we'll see. What is Qatar getting us, really? There's some personal interest for Trump, but what's this allyship going to get us?
Nothing. The last leg of the trip was UAE, which I guess has the most direct benefits for the United States. There's a $60 billion Occidental Petroleum. Don't forget, Occidental Petroleum is tied to Affinity Partners, which belongs to Jared Kushner. So they got a $60 billion oil and gas contract, the EGA, $4 billion smelter in Oklahoma. There's a $4 billion investment by Emirates Global Aluminum to build a new aluminum smelting factory in Oklahoma. But the EGA is majority owned by Mubadala, which is just the UAE's sovereign wealth fund. So it really belongs to the royal family. Don't forget, the royal family is also an investor in X and XAI. It's like a circle jerk. And they're also financially tied to Affinity Partners. So why would a Emirati-owned aluminum smelter in Oklahoma benefit us?
Exactly.
Okay. I have to ask because I'm not sure. This was the one that, and maybe you don't agree with me, but this next deal was the $14 billion Etihad Airways deal, which promised to purchase 20 787 Dreamliners and 8 Boeing 777X aircraft, all aircraft to be powered by GE Aerospace engines. But Boeing can't even keep their own planes off the ground. So they're going to build another fleet for the UAE. And they're facing a severe lack of international confidence, right? China just said, we're no longer even going to use these anymore. We're just going to switch over to Airbus. They're much more reliable. So what I think this really was to prop up Boeing, to push their stock back up, to say there isn't really a loss of confidence. And like we just said, these people don't really care about money. So what's $14 billion to them if they get planes later on?
It's kind of like when you get your buddy to come to an auction to like keep raising the price up.
Yeah.
And just keeping it high. Yeah, I think that's good analysis, by the way, on Boeing. And yeah, I mean, for me, I'm just like, how long, remember peak oil? Remember that concept of peak oil? Like how long does Qatar and Saudi and these states have where they are sitting on oil and, you know, they can throw it around? Like one day that oil will dry up, right? And so then are they diversified enough when that time comes to, you know, kind of continue influencing stuff, or do they just drop dead immediately on the spot? I don't know. I don't know when peak oil, how much oil is left in the world, but it just it strikes me as insanely. I don't want to say the word unfair because that's, you know, but it just are they assessing the quantity correctly? Like, how do they have that much oil to have this much dough to throw around?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the Emiratis diversified well, so maybe they're following that model. Plus, Qatar is getting heavily involved in lobbying and kind of manipulating international politics. Lastly, the AI campus. I don't know why UAE is doing this, but they're building a 10-mile-long AI hub in Abu Dhabi, which is constructed by G42, which is the UAE's government-backed company. The problem with G42 is that it still does have, they've just scrubbed the public record of them, very, very strong ties to China, with Huawei, ByteDance, who's TikTok's parent company, and military-adjacent research institutes. In 2022 and 2023, G42 was actually flagged by the U.S. national security officials because of their technology transfer risks. So they were feeding technology to China, which I'm not against, but I know this administration is allegedly against. But then we came to find out that TikTok inserted $300 million and bought Trump's shitcoin. So ByteDance just bought $300 million of Trump's shitcoin while Trump does a deal with ByteDance's partner in the UAE.
You didn't say those shitcoins are just a great way to launder.
Never buying the dip. Why don't we buy the dip? We never buy the dip.
Yeah. I mean, that is what they're for. I mean, that it's a great way to, get a cash injection that's off the books. There's all these various conflicts of interest. I don't get where the watchdog or whatever the agencies that, look at this or say, is there no recourse? I mean, probably we're just in one of those kind of eras where, the corruption rules, but, this will probably be the theme, of this administration where, this personal type of politics where bribery and transactions, rule the day. I hate to sound like a lib, and kind of just buy into institutionalism and faith in the system. But I'm normally not a fan of like this type of stuff either.
I'm not either, but I don't look at it from a legal perspective. It's for me, it's more of an ethical thing. I don't know.
You see that he said, so when he was whining about the plane, he was like, that plane, Air Force One is so old and rickety. The old other leaders are going to laugh at me when I come in this plane. I forget which article had that quote, but
wow.
Basically he was not happy with the state of Air Force One.
Okay.
And so they fulfilled the real need for him. The Qataris when they gave him that plane.
I think the whole trip did. As someone who grew up around Trump's collapsing empire and Atlantic City and New York City, I could tell you that Trump probably, I've been to Dubai more than once. And I've only been to Saudi by accident once. I've never been to Qatar. But just from seeing it, Trump walked in and saw all that glitz and glam and stucco and all of the nonsense and said, that's obviously success. That's success. That's how we project power and success. Gold-plated everything and Benihana. Like, it's really just that superficial. And I think that that's really what won him over. Because you're not going to get that in Tel Aviv. You're not going to get that when you go to Israel. There's none of that.
Sort of like it's flashy, but it's in a sense cheap. Like there's no depth to it. But
that's what he is. He's very gaudy and gauche. I mean, look at his penthouse. Remember the penthouse pictures with Baron riding the lion, like, or whatever it was. Like just so like over the top, toilet, yeah. Gold on the gold toilet, gold on the walls. Like, and everybody's like, why are you doing this? Just to be opulent for the sake of being opulent. It's just it's kind of over the top. But I want your opinion on these following clips. So Trump came back and did an interview with Bret Baier from Fox, who I really don't mind that much. We used one of the clips earlier for the Shura, but there's some other clips that I wanted to show to Marat. We played a few in the space the other night, if you guys were there, but Trump actually reveals why he went to the Gulf.
Well, I always considered it to be a very important region. I know all three leaders, as you could see, very well. In all three cases, I knew them long before I ran for politics, which is sort of something. It makes it a little bit more special. They're great people, the three of them. They're great people. And it's a great region, but it was never treated properly. And it was certainly not treated well by Biden, who didn't know he was alive, frankly. So, you can understand that. But he was not, they didn't treat this group well. And I think they were being, and I guess because you've reported on it, they were being coaxed very strongly by China, because that solves China's fuel problem forever. And it wasn't their preference, but they were on their way. They were going to China, and that was going to be their parent. And that's not happening anymore.
Do you think you've shifted the paradigm on that?
No, I don't think. I know. We are... as close, we're closer now to them than ever before. You could see the relationship. You can, you could get a buddy expert and pay them a lot of money. They could tell you, no, there's just a relationship that I have with all three that's just, you know, very extraordinary. I was even saying, you know, I mean, we're like so friendly, not a normal situation where you, you know, you're okay with a leader or whatever. But this is a very important region. This is the energy capital of the world. They have, you know, massive amounts of energy and other things. They've invested wisely, and they're looking to do other things. I guess in Saudi Arabia, they said in another couple of years, there'll be more than 50% other businesses represent more than 50% of the take. And it's pretty amazing what all of them have done.
Kind of gives it away a little bit. He kind of says the quiet part out loud. Some people like that, I guess.
Well, I'm interested what you mean by that, but the every time he talks, it's the same. I mean, like he, his emphasis on his relationship with the leaders, as if like he built that up himself, and it's not just a function of his office, right? He's just like, I knew all three of them before. Is that true? Like, did he know Mohammed bin Salman? I'm not sure he did, but.
I don't know that he did, but Jared Kushner sure did.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, and then he essentially just says nothing, right? Like he talks a whole lot. That's why I'm almost like, are you sure he said the quiet part out loud? Because he might not even have known what he said. I don't even think he realizes.
You are very friendly. Very friendly. Very, very friendly.
He's like, we'll get a body expert.
Pay him a lot of money. Pay them a lot of money. I'm going to be a body expert. We have other clips too. This is Trump bringing up Iran.
So how do you get to a solution there?
Oh, we'll get 100%.
You think so?
Well, we're going to have a solution one way or the other. It's either going to be violent or not violent. And I far prefer nonviolent. I know so many Iranians from New York, from Washington, from a different place. These are great people. You know, you have to view them as people. And I don't want it to be a violent thing, but they're not going to have a nuclear weapon.
But you said it was close the other day. You said it was close to a deal.
I think it's close. I think,
so does that mean that they're going to enrich at any level, like a civilian level?
No, I think they want to make a deal. You know, you say to yourself, they have massive oil, by the way. They have oil that lasts for 300 years. They have a lot of oil. People don't realize they're one of the biggest in the world. And it's very good oil, meaning it's pure, perfect stuff. They don't have to, you know, spend a fortune on gases and energy in order to melt the rock and everything. They have pure, unadulterated, good oil. And you say, why does somebody that has that kind of oil, other than being politically correct, but when you have unlimited amounts of oil and gas, why are you putting up, you know, why do you need civil nuclear? I just don't see it.
But I mean, are you going to call for it all?
And I think nuclear is fine. I think nuclear is fine for civil if you have a country with no oil. But if you're sitting on one of the largest piles of oil in the world, why are you talking about putting up nuclear civil? I call it nuclear civil.
Call it nuclear civil.
I mean, again, like words come out. What is he saying? I mean, they just let him kind of talk and ramble on it. But yeah, I mean, I didn't even get too much out of that clip.
Not at all.
What is he talking about?
Nuclear civil, which, by the way, he just approved nuclear civil. I'm just going to call it that from now on. Nuclear civil for Saudi Arabia. So why does Saudi get nuclear civil with all that big, beautiful oil?
Also, don't you feel like the way he's talking about the potential, you know, Iran deal, and there's 2 days left, right, from the deadline, it was like the 20th, this just tells me there's going to be no deal for sure, because sure. When he talks like this, that means like there's going to be nothing, because he's just trying to sell hope, right? If they did feel good about a deal, he would have been talking tough right now and acting like there's not going to be a deal. This is always just what he does.
There was no deal. The talks concluded today, fourth round of talks, no deal. No set in stone date for the fifth round of talks. So that's that. I can't remember if it was the 20th or the 25th for that deadline, but yeah, it's quickly approaching. So that's a good segue into Trump starting to talk about Gaza a little bit more. This is the first clip.
I think Iran is right now the big problem. That's also a problem. Hamas is big, and we want to take care of the people. Look, people are starving. You know, you see what's going on right now. People are starving. One of the things that one of the three great leaders that I saw two nights ago said to me, please help the people, the Palestinians. I said, other than the obvious, what do you mean by that? He said, they're starving. And he meant it with his heart. They're starving. So I've already started working on that. It's a deep problem, but we'll get it solved. And a very immediate and a very big problem is, you know, I'm so proud of what we were able to do with India and with Pakistan. Well, it's a potential problem like that that we have here. I'll get it solved, and one way or the other, I'll get it solved. It's either going to be done nicely or it's going to be done violently. And I 99.9% want to do it nicely if we can.
The round is causing Gaza to starve?
When they call this, can you please help us? And he's like, what do you mean by that?
Other than the obvious, what do you want me to do?
The Gaza thing is where he, you know, we get into the real kind of the far-fetched and the ridiculous. Not to kind of jump ahead, but, you know, perhaps I should just let you introduce it, the Libya, rumor and the, you know, Freedom Zone, which
we have a clip on that too. Yeah.
You know, these, and go ahead and play them, but yeah, like this kind of just shows that like, he has some like kind of fantastical concepts in mind, which I don't know if people are telling him that this.
We'll play the Freedom Zone real quick.
And you think the Israel-Hamas, the situation in Gaza is going to come to an end soon?
Gaza's a nasty place. It's been that way for years. I think it should become a free zone. You know, freedom. I call it a freedom zone. It should become a freedom zone. It doesn't work. Every 10 years they go back, they have Hamas. Everybody's being killed all over the place. I mean, you ever see, you talk about crime stats. It's a nasty place.
Are these people, these countries that you were just visiting, are they going to have to be a part of the solution?
Well, they would be. They would be. I spoke to all three of them. They would absolutely be. I mean, they're really rich and really, 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 even more than rich. They're good people. And they would help. And so money's not even the problem.
Well, you got to get countries to say yes. Take them.
Look, these are people that want to be in the Middle East. They really want to be in the Middle East. They love the Middle East. I see that. There's a spirit for the Middle East. They didn't have to go to Sweden, Germany, these different countries. They could have been home in the Middle East if somebody had the brains to build beautiful communities. You know, 1.9 million is a lot of people, but it's not a lot of people, relatively.
You know,
It was a NIMBY issue. They were just not building.
There was a NIMBY issue.
You know, I think
real estate and crime statistics are the problem in Palestine.
I think I know what a freedom zone is. I think it's like when you friend zone someone, but it's with sovereignty. The thing is that with his real estate like brain just can only think of like, I'm gonna build and there's gonna be peace there. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to solve this problem because no one had thought of doing this. When he's like the crime stats there, you know, not good. It's like, okay, bro. Is it like none of this grounded in reality? You know, who would be traveling there to this freedom zone in Gaza? And what would they do there once they're going to go to the resorts or whatever, like the beaches, I suppose? The
Trump Tower, Damascus.
Not feasible.
It's not even that. It's like, what are you talking about? Plenty of people have offered them other places in the Levant. What happened when they went to Jordan? What happened when they went to Lebanon? They're still in Lebanon and Syria. Like, what are you even talking about? Like, and just so our viewers know, he's been floating the idea of Libya, and we won't go into it heavily because we still don't have a very clear picture, but he's floating the idea of sending them to Libya, a million of them, while Libya is on the brink of civil war, absolute crisis, and a proxy war with Turkey versus Russia, which I'm sure the United States is involved on the side of Turkey. So amidst all this turmoil, Libya is supposed to officially respond to Trump's plans to relocate a million Palestinians. Now, what do you think a million Palestinians who have just been through a genocide for 2 years are going to do when they get to Libya in an extreme, a war between extremist factions? They're probably going to join.
First, you got the war. Yeah, they're probably going to join. Second, the proportion of the population. I mean, 5 million Syrians in Europe was destabilized. But the population of Libya is, I believe, 6 million. So adding a million is it's a whole 16%, one sixth of the population. So it's like it's a very big change, and it's just further shows just how unrealistic that sort of idea would be. We're just kind of spitballing ideas there. Nothing really serious. I don't even see how that would work.
And this next clip, I'm really proud of us because we didn't buy into the hype. We almost did, but we didn't buy into the hype about the Trump-Bibi rift. I don't know if you guys remember last week, we said we didn't believe it and we tried to prove ourselves wrong by showing evidence that maybe there was a little bit of a rift, but Trump clarifies that in his interview with Bayer.
Are you frustrated at all with Prime Minister Netanyahu?
No, look, he's got a tough situation. You have to remember there was an October 7th that everyone forgets. It was one of the most violent days in the history of the world, not the Middle East, the world, when you look at the tapes. And the tapes are there for everyone to see. So he has that problem. That problem should have never happened. Now, if I were president, that problem wouldn't have happened because Iran had no money. They were stone cold broke.
And I hate to laugh because of this, the dire situation that Gaza is now in today, literally, at this moment. But why did we go through a week of messing about just to distance themselves from what's definitely to come?
Yeah, that was easy. I mean, that he just was like, oh, yeah, that was great. People forget how bad October 7th was. Remember?
Yeah.
I mean, every time I see this kind of stuff, I just see that they don't even put that much effort in the sort of wrap up when they backtrack. They're just kind of like, oh, yeah, what was that? I don't remember. Yeah. Anyway, squirrel. It's just like that's just it. I mean, that's how quick and easy it is.
So Trump, even let's say hypothetically, Trump did kind of abandon Bibi. That means Bibi goes into election, likely won't win. Don't you think that it's more advantageous for Bibi to leave or for Trump to leave Bibi in? He has leverage over Bibi, number one. Number two, it could create a lot of turmoil inside of Israel and political upheaval.
And the election is 2026. Right?
I think so.
Definitely. I think for the U.S. and for Trump personally, for the U.S. from national interests, I think they don't want to see a change of power, in the midst of all this. I 100% agree with you. That doesn't serve our interests or Trump's. We'll probably just see more kabuki theater and stuff. But yeah, they'll probably be sure that he stays in.
I think so, too. I think so, too. I think it's way more advantageous to keep people like Zelensky, Shirah, and Bibi in power. You have so much leverage over them. People that know that if you abandon them, they'll be completely out of office and power and probably in the hands of people that don't really like them. So you have quite a bit of leverage. I wanted to end on this note because it's probably the most important of the week, given all of the lead up to this. On Wednesday, Mossad, I noted this on Thursday during my stream with Nick, but on Wednesday, Mossad did announce that Operation Gideon's Chariots would commence on Saturday, yesterday. They did do quite a bit of setting up and clearing out in the lead up to that, but it definitely huge offensive did begin yesterday by land, air, and sea. This is the first phase, which is part of a long-term reoccupation strategy. The stated objectives from the IDF are to seize strategic areas and permanently retain them, to defeat Hamas completely militarily, to secure the release of the remaining 59 hostages, dead or alive, to relocate Gaza's civilian population to the southern region and suggest voluntary relocation abroad, and to replace international aid efforts with IDF-run distribution hubs. This puts 1.9 million Gazans at risk. I just wanted to make a note of the historical parallels. Operation Gideon in 1948 was an integral part of the Nakba carried out by the Haganah. And obviously the biblical reference to Gideon, whose small army of 300 purged enemies under divine command. So that sort of messianic framing of this military conquest again. Any thoughts on what?
I've been a skeptic of the Greater Israel Project line, right? Because I was kind of skeptical of how much further they would want to have expanded. But this week, someone had made this point, and I've been kind of thinking on it. So their theory was that this is all kind of a play to create a second Suez Canal. But essentially, this is about the Sinai and to not rely on Egypt for that access, for the Suez. And that kind of has just been the whole play for Israel this whole time. That's a compelling theory for me. And so when we hear about Gaza and Operation Gideon and kind of just all these various plans, it does start to shape kind of from before, where it was just this, not a conspiracy theory, but kind of this far-fetched, an idea of this greater Israel project. But little by little, I do kind of see the path that they're going towards, or the vision. If it is about, waterways and access, and that is certainly one of the oldest stories in geopolitics, is kind of finding trade routes and stuff like that. But yeah, that was definitely something that to think about this week when I heard that.
I think that's the thing that a lot of people run into with Israel. They're like, well, is it an ideological thing? Is it a religious thing? Is it about supply routes? And you're like, it can be all of those things. And I think that Israel sort of hit the jackpot with this because it fits the narrative for so many different causes. I want greater Israel. Okay, we're going to do that. I want access to trade routes. Okay, we're going to take over the Sinai. We need to worry about our water. Okay, we'll do take care of that. All of these things are wrapped up into this conflict. And so it caters to so many different factions.
Exactly.
Also, and the producer just sent me this, the office of Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has announced that Israel will permit the entry of a basic volume of food supplies into the Gaza Strip in order to prevent famine. So maybe he did a little bit of pressure from Trump, and now Trump can call that a win. Another win, a ceasefire in India. Aid into Gaza. Wow, just racking up the W's here. That's just scary. A basic volume of food supplies. I guess that Trump acknowledging that they were starving was a good catalyst in this instance, I'm guessing.
Yeah, they got, I don't know, Popeye's chicken or something sent over to them.
I love Popeye's chicken. I actually harassed them on Twitter to send me Black and Ranch. But anyway, that's a different story for another time. Don't mean to introduce levity when we're talking about Palestine. My apologies. And then I had one more thing that I wanted to say about the Palestine thing, but I can't recall. I think that's it. But Romanian elections today, looks like there was a bit of an upset. Simeon is projected to not win. So the non-nationalist candidate will win. But the reason why I'm mentioning it is because Pavel Durov came out and said that he was being pressured by the French to ban conservative voices ahead of elections, which he refused. Pretty interesting. Western European government, guess which, approached Telegram asking us to silence conservative voices ahead of the presidential election. That's pretty incredible.
What?
Not that they did it, that Pavel Durov said it out loud. And now we have more proof of our theory that as these liberal regimes lose power, they backslide into fascistic tactics, I guess.
But they also don't inspire as much confidence to where someone like Durov will just go ahead and say it, whereas before maybe he might not have. That is jarring that... He what would he be facing now for having revealed this?
Who knows? And he's under their custody. He's under, this is that's quite brave of Pavel Durov to say that. So he's in their custody. Oh, and here's the elections. We see 54% to 45%, even though Simeon announced his victory. I guess maybe he jinxed it. Not really too sure, but we'll keep covering that. And Iran talks and Trump's conversation with Putin tomorrow. Closing thoughts. Did we miss anything, Murat? I don't know if we did.
Yeah, if we did, on the Ukraine Russia point, I think that as I mentioned earlier, every week I come here and it feels like it gets dragged out longer. So for the time being, I haven't seen anything that would give me optimism about these talks. I think this is just going to be a lot more hot air tomorrow.
Do you want to play this really quickly? This is a visual of Operation Gideon's Chariots. So obviously moving the people to the south. And I wanted to play that because the humanitarian zone or the safe zone is not as big as you thought it was. It's not the whole south of Gaza. It's just that little chunk by the Rafah border crossing. So 2 million Gazans in that area. Probably should end on the note of Gaza because I really want to convey the seriousness of this and that this looks like it's part of the last push to fully eradicate the Palestinians or to at least ethnically cleanse the areas that they need.
And it's like, it's a real shame that, due to events historically in Syria, when the Palestinians were there, the other Arab countries have been they've indicated that they don't have any interest in taking these people on, which is a real shame because, they are, neighbors.
Well,
and they're not like in a different ethnic group to where you're being like.
Who could feasibly take them? Jordan already has Jordan is Palestine, pretty much. It's all Palestinians. Syria is is ready to collapse, the brink of collapse. Lebanon has the noose tightening around its neck. I don't even think they'd be allowed to take more. Who will take?
Egypt is, kind of a logical choice, and also just kind of splitting them up in between them. I don't know. Just it feels kind of shitty to.
I don't even like talking about it because I know they don't want to leave at all. That the idea that Trump's trying to float that as long as we keep them in the Middle East, they'll be happy. That's not true. Sure. Yeah. So it's like, I guess that's a choice. We can discuss it, but it's obviously a choice up to the Palestinians to leave voluntarily or to stay.
Right. But not just but if you are like a sense of autonomy or choice there so that you're not just being like pushed out or kicked out of a place you don't want to go. That's all.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it at that. And that sad note appropriately. And we will see you guys next week. Please, please, please engage with the Twitter and the YouTube if you can and you have time. And share it. We are shadow banned on both. And please keep up to date with what's going on in Palestine. We will try to do our best to keep you guys up to date as well. Thank you guys and enjoy the rest of your Sunday and have a good week.